Welcome back to the program. Rahm Emanuel, the current mayor of Chicago and the president's former chief of staff, said during the height of the economic crisis that would bring the country to its knees that you should never let a serious crisis go to waste. President Obama certainly did not. Our guest today, Time Magazine senior national correspondent Michael Grunewald, shows us that it's never been clearer how the Obama administration heeded that advice. The stimulus that arguably saved the U.S. economy, a stimulus that we're barely talking about in the context of the current election, was one of the most profound pieces of legislation since the New Deal. It is perhaps the 800 billion pound gorilla that is reshaping America. Michael Grunewald is a senior national correspondent for Time Magazine. He won the George Polk Award for National Reporting. And it is my pleasure to welcome Michael Grunewald here to talk about his book, The New New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. Michael Grunewald, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
It's good to have you here. When we look at all of the things now that were part of the stimulus, it's kind of like, and I think somebody had said this previously, a kind of presidency in a box. It was like a whole administration all built into one piece of legislation.
It was the purification of what Obama meant by change. I quoted one of his aides who had worked for Clinton and then worked for Obama, who said that we did more in that one bill that we passed during our first month than Clinton did in 8 years. It's the largest energy bill in the history of the planet. It's groundwork for healthcare reform. It's the most aggressive education reform with rates at the top in decades. It's the largest infrastructure investment since Eisenhower, the largest one-time research investments ever, the largest middle-class tax cut since Reagan. And then, oh, by the way, you know, it did help prevent a depression when we were, you know, collapsing at a 9% annual rate in the fourth quarter of 2008. The stimulus came in at a time when we were losing 800,000 jobs a month. The next quarter, we had the biggest improvement in jobs since in 30 years. So again, it was called the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and it did a lot of short-term recovery and long-term reinvestment.
Was there a sense in the White House at the time of all that they were trying to do, that this stimulus was going to have a short-term impact in terms of the money that would go to the states, the unemployment, the food stamps, all the short-term benefit that it had, but all of the long-term benefit in terms of all these things you're talking about, did they understand that that was very much a part of what they were trying to do? And if it was, why weren't they prepared to do a better job of selling it?
Well, I think the short answer is yes. I got a hold of all the internal documents where they were putting this thing together, and they thought long and hard about to what extent they needed to focus on the immediate short term, preventing sort of unfathomable collapse, and to what extent they could invest in the long term agenda, because after an epic financial cataclysm, the recoveries are always going to be longer and tougher. They did feel like they had some economic headroom, that you didn't want to try to blast all the money out the door in 6 months. You're going to need support for several years, which allowed some room for the kind of change we can believe in stuff that they wanted to do anyway. Selling it, I write in depth in the book about how the message got muddled. We can talk about that. I always like to point out that this black guy whose middle name is Hussein and got himself elected president probably didn't become a political idiot on January 20th, 2009.
Right.
And so the first thing I always say is that this was always going to be a very tough sell. You know, the financial earthquake had already hit, but the economic tsunami hadn't really hit the shore. So as Larry Summers, I quote him talking in December 2008, how FDR was lucky. There had been 3 years of depression before he took over. Everybody knew it was Herbert Hoover's depression. While with Obama, you know, he was sort of catching a falling spear. The unemployment rate was still pretty low when he took over, and there was no amount of stimulus that could have kept it down in any reasonable time frame. So it was always going to be a jobs bill that passed at a time when jobs were disappearing, and it was always going to be $800 billion in borrowed money passed at a time when homes and families and businesses were tightening their belts. So I always start out by saying it was a tough sell. That said, the Republicans did an amazing job of distorting it and making it sound like $800 billion worth of levitating trains to Disneyland and mob museums and other nonsense that wasn't in the bill. The Obama administration really had a muddled message. The Democrats, instead of defending it, were mostly whining that it was too small or too many tax cuts. And media really screwed up the story as badly as they screwed up the run-up to the war in Iraq. So it was really a perfect storm of bad politics.
One of the things you talk about is the fact that the administration gave the perception, at least, that it was kind of outsourcing the stimulus to Congress as opposed to really taking the bull by the horns.
Well, it's there are elements of truth to it, but then there are elements of where it isn't true. Obama did want a more cooperative relationship with Congress. He didn't want to repeat what they call the stone tablets approach that President Clinton tried with health care, mm-hmm. where you in secret put together your plan and then dump it on some committee chairman's desk and say, pass it. That was not he had served a little bit in the Senate, and his administration was really dominated by not just Joe Biden and Rahm Emanuel, who had both, served in Congress, but really just a lot of people who really knew the Hill well and felt that the way to go was to be more cooperative. One thing that President Obama understood from the beginning was that bills that don't pass Congress don't produce change. And that after all his fancy talk about, government campaigning as a change the system outsider, he was going to have to govern as a work the system insider and get 60 votes in the Senate, because otherwise nothing was going to happen and the economy was going to collapse. So to get 60 votes when you had 3 Republican senators and 6 Democratic senators who were saying absolutely no more than $800 billion, that meant it wasn't going to be more than $800 billion. And then when you had Arlen Specter insist on $10 billion for medical research and Blanche Lincoln wanted her catfish subsidies, there really wasn't much you could do but give it to him. When Susan Collins said that Obama couldn't have his $10 billion school building program for the entire country, that fell out of the bill. So there was a sense that he was constrained by Congress. But that said, this was Obama's bill. It was Obama's vision. It followed Obama's framework. All the main pieces of it came from Obama. While he didn't specifically write it, he really drove the process. And at the end, I did get a hold of the document where after the House passed the bill and the Senate passed a different bill, Rahm Emanuel walked in with a list of spending items and saying, all right, well, this is where we're going to end up. And that was pretty much where it did end up.
To what extent did they understand that this was clearly two-part messaging, that politically they were looking at short-term recovery as well as transforming the economy in the long term? And why was simply the simplicity of that idea not part of what they were selling?
It was part of what they were selling. And it's funny, they thought a lot of these two-part messages would really, were not that complicated, right? We have $300 billion in tax cuts in this bill, but we're also going to have $500 billion of spending. We're going to focus on stimulating the economy in the short term, but then we're going to pivot towards fiscal responsibility in the long term. Those don't seem like really complicated messages, but the Republicans had an even simpler one-part message, which was no. And that was a lot easier to get across. They just hammered it again and again. Big spending, big mess, big government. And the Democrats really struggled to have a response to that. For one part, Obama was, he wasn't that all that comfortable starting out his presidency with a big spending bill. He's the kind of guy who likes to be the dad taking away your keys and not the teenager binging at the mall. Mm-hmm. It sort of more fits his self-image. And so he was always a little bit apologetic, always talking about how this wasn't a perfect bill by any means. Nobody was standing up and saying it was a great thing. And then once it passed, he was on to the next. He was on to the equally unpopular auto bailout and then the even more unpopular healthcare reforms. while Republicans were just relentless in their message. I tell the story about how after that first House Republican unanimous vote against the stimulus, which of course passed anyway in the House because Democrats controlled it, but Republicans were ecstatic. And they had a retreat in Virginia where John Boehner, who's now the Speaker of the House, played a tape from C-SPAN of that vote of Republicans kind of getting their butts kicked, but finally coming together and saying no. And John, you know, he got a standing ovation. Eric Cantor, his deputy, jumped up and said, "We're going to have more votes just like this." Mike Pence, another member of the Republican leadership, played a tape from Patton where the general saying, "We're going to run through the enemy like crap through a goose." And of course, Patton was talking about the Nazis. Pence was talking about Obama. But they were really thrilled because they knew that by holding together and keeping the Obama agenda controversial, even if it was passing, they were sort of going to bring him down from that 70% approval rating when 2 million people were saying, "Yes, we can," on the mall, to the sort of traditional politician in a polarized country. And they were very effective at that.
And they, as you talk about, they started thinking about this even before Obama took office. In December of 2008, you talk about a meeting with Mitch McConnell and Eric Cantor.
That's right. I mean, they really did understand from the beginning, at a time when the conventional wisdom in Washington was, you know, Obama, he's the first black president. This is an economic emergency. Democrats just helped President Bush do something for Wall Street. I mean, surely the Republicans are going to have to help Obama do something for Main Street. And they recognized right away that no was their path back to power. Mitch McConnell liked to talk about the 1984 election, which everybody remembers as Ronald Reagan's Morning in America landslide. But what McConnell remembered was that just about every Democratic incumbent was reelected. And he would tell his caucus that. And his point was, look, if somehow Obama turns this thing around and the economy is great, we're all going to get reelected anyway, because people get reelected when the voters are fat and happy. But if we say no, and as we all know, this is like an economic mess, and there's no way he's going to clean it up in 2 years. That can be our path back from oblivion. And they were very shrewd about that. They told their members, you know, you can do whatever you want. You can say whatever you want. We'll come up with whatever stimulus alternatives you want. But when it comes to the big vote on Obama, you vote no. And look, House Republicans, including Paul Ryan, for a $715 billion stimulus alternative that was almost identical to Obama's $787 billion stimulus. And it was, you know, it was never clear how Paul Ryan's stimulus was good public policy while Obama's was Sharia socialism and the death of free enterprise. But, you know, that's not the sort of thing you have to explain when you're in the minority. And it was smart politics, even it was completely cynical.
Given the way things have played out, was Obama smarter initially? Did he really understand that he was playing for the long game?
You know, I think, the Obama who's portrayed in my book I think it's a really exciting book, and then I have a lot of fun Obama stories, but he sort of comes off as the same kind of left of center, pragmatic technocrat that he's always portrayed himself as. And I think he, you know, there's not this huge arc of, you know, unlike a lot of the books where, you know, he starts out, oh, he has no idea what's going on, and then he learns how Washington works, but then he's feckless and they lose the, you know, mm-hmm. It's more, he's kind of the same guy all along. And I do think there was this aura blowing from the top, where we're just going to try to focus on the policy and do the stuff that we said we were going to try to do during the campaign. And we'll let the politics fall, you know, those chips will fall where they may. Now, look, there were times where, you know, the perfect example being his middle class tax cuts, which went to more than 95% of the country and less than 10% of the country noticed, which was clearly political malpractice. And they thought they would do it just by dribbling out a few dollars a week into your paycheck instead of sending you a big check that you'd notice and appreciate. And as I quoted one of his aides saying, in retrospect, that was just stupid. But in general, the idea was, well, we're going to try to do stuff. And I think looking back, where, you know, part of my argument of this book is that he did do an awful lot of stuff where you put $90 billion into clean energy when we'd been spending just a few billion dollars, and we've doubled renewable energy in this country and jump-started the electric vehicle industry and advanced biofuels and the smart grid, where you've dragged our pen and paper healthcare system into the digital age, where you're starting to reform education, you're expanding broadband to, which is sort of a modern version of rural electrification. You've got a new high-speed rail program. He did a lot of stuff, and then he went on to do, to provide health care insurance to the uninsured and reform the rules of Wall Street that led to the last financial crisis. And a lot of this really took a political price. And yet, 4 years later, with unemployment still appallingly high, his approval ratings are still pretty decent. So I think one of the sort of meta lessons of this book is, when you're in power, you kind of ought to use it, because, it's a pretty divided country, and there are going to be political costs to anything you do. Might as well do the stuff you sort of said you wanted to do.
The sort of opposite of all of this is when we look at Roosevelt during the New Deal, where he did all of these things, but in some ways through this idea of bold, persistent experimentation, kind of brought everybody else, or at least was perceived to have brought others in the process.
Look, FDR had much bigger majorities, and he also had the luxury, if you call it that, of taking over when unemployment was 25%. So there really was no way to go but up. The banks had just all, he closed the banks on his first day in office. He made no effort to help Hoover during his transition, unlike Obama, who really provided cover for Bush, and helped pass the bank bailout that helped prevent a disaster. And there was a different Republican Party in those days where, there were progressive Republicans, which you don't have now, where now the most liberal Republican is still more conservative than the most conservative Democrat. So I think it was a different time. He really did have a tough sell. Remember, even the New Deal, which certainly helped lower the unemployment rate through 1937. But then when FDR turned to austerity, you started going in the wrong direction again, mm-hmm. until World War II, which was really kind of the mother of all stimulus pills. Another one of the lessons of the book is you really ought to try to avoid having epic financial collapses, because they're really difficult to recover from.
One of the things you point out is that Americans hated the stimulus in total, but yet when you take individual things out of it, they kind of like it.
That's right. I mean, it's similar to the way Americans say they don't like government, but they love, defense spending and, Medicare and Social Security and unemployment benefits and the stuff that makes up most of government. The stimulus, when you pull the individual elements of it, expanded unemployment benefits and many things that had always had bipartisan support, like small business tax cuts and health information technology so that your doctor doesn't kill you with his chicken scratch handwriting, and, a smarter grid, so that a tree branch doesn't fall in Cleveland and black out 8 states. These things all pull very well. Building roads and bridges and subways, all of that is still very popular. But a year after the stimulus passed, the percentage of Americans who believed the stimulus had created any jobs was lower than the percentage of Americans who believed that Elvis was alive. So I do think, in the same way that Americans are anti-government while liking its benefits, they seem to feel the same way about the stimulus. And you do start to hear Obama, who has specifically embraced the auto rescue and Obamacare. He has not embraced stimulus that way. He doesn't even say the word stimulus, but he does talk about what it's done for clean energy, how it's reduced middle-class taxes, how it's provided, how it's doubled renewable energy. I mean, he's at least talking about the benefits.
And it's created an interesting conundrum in a lot of states as a result of the $180 billion that initially went to the states and righted a lot of situations, and yet a lot of Republican governors have managed to ignore that fact.
Yeah, well, that was one of another example of how they really did try to do the right thing, even though the politics stunk. Here you had in January 2009, Republicans running around saying, we don't want the money. We don't want to see a federal spending spree. Do it yourself. We're not interested. But the economist said, basically, if we don't do something for these states, they all have balanced budget requirements, and they are going to lay off hundreds of thousands of teachers and cops and other public employees and completely devastate their Medicaid programs, health care for the poor. So they bit the bullet and poured in a couple $100 billion to the states, and every one of these Republican governors took the money. And they balanced their budgets and then turned around and beat up on Congress for not balancing theirs. So it was a real political price, but it did help prevent, at a time when we really were in a death spiral and hundreds of thousands more layoffs at the public level, those are more people who won't be spending money and buying stuff, and which means that the grocery store is going to be laying off their people, and those are more people. That's how depressions happen. It did help stop the panic, but you don't get a lot of credit for things would have been worse.
And Democrats in Congress didn't acquit themselves very well in all of this. You tell the story about a screaming match between Vice President Joe Biden and Steny Hoyer, talking about stop talking about all that you want more money and talk about what the money did.
Right. What Biden said to Hoyer, and it kind of made a certain amount of sense, is that all the Democrats were running around saying, the stimulus isn't working, the stimulus isn't working, we need more stimulus. Biden pointed out, hey, wouldn't it be a better argument that, hey, the stimulus is working, we need more stimulus? And one of the untold stories of the Obama administration, particularly among the disillusionment addicts of the left, who are, whining, Obama, it was like the war, the war in Iraq, and he never followed up with the surge. Where was the additional stimulus? In fact, he sort of quietly came up with another $700 billion of additional stimulus that didn't get a lot of attention because he wasn't running around saying we need a second stimulus, which just would have, made it into a big target since stimulus was so toxic. But he did pass additional aid to states. And, despite overwhelming opposition from Republicans, where I had some Republicans talking on the record about how Mitch McConnell was telling them, we don't care about the substance, we just need to oppose this stuff because it's Obama's. He passed small business tax cuts, which you'd think would be classic Republican policy, but they opposed that en masse. They passed additional unemployment benefits, which had always been completely uncontroversial, but Republicans opposed that too. But so there was a real effort to get more stimulus, even though the messaging and the politics had become so toxic.
What did the Republicans think would happen without the stimulus? I mean, had they been successful in stopping it or significantly reducing it, how did they think it would play out?
It's funny. I think that there's obviously, we're having now this debate about the role of government and Republicans who, in the same way that, Mitt Romney's individual mandate for health care has become suddenly that socialism, and the cap and trade plan that McCain and Palin supported in 2008 has become socialism. The idea of stimulus has suddenly become this toxic Obama, big government boondoggle. While in 2008, every Republican and Democratic candidate for president supported a stimulus, Mitt Romney supported the largest one. And as I mentioned, Paul Ryan voted for a $715 billion stimulus. He was also one of 128 cash and trash House Republicans who voted against the stimulus and then have sent letters to the Obama administration begging for stimulus money for their districts, or, you know, have attended ribbon cuttings or put out press releases bragging about stimulus projects. I think the good news is that, you know, for people who are worried about what's going to happen during the next downturn, is that Republicans do not actually seem to believe in the idea that, you know, government can't create jobs and that stimulus spending is some kind of socialism. You can see it when there's this discussion of the fiscal cliff, which is supposedly coming in January 2013, where there might be these automatic massive cuts in social spending and defense. And Republicans are running around saying, oh, this is horrible. If these defense cuts happen, it's going to cost jobs. And, you know, it's sort of like, huh, really? Government spending creates jobs? Cutting spending reduces jobs? Since when? We've seen what happens in Great Britain and Spain, which have enacted the kind of austerity programs that Republicans have at least said they support. You know, let's cut the budget right now, that'll reduce the economy. Well, it certainly hasn't worked in Spain and Britain, where they're having a double dip recession. And I think it's a pretty good bet that if Republicans did take office, they would, while continuing their enthusiasm about cutting taxes, we'll see what would happen to their enthusiasm about cutting spending. Because generally, when they get the keys to the car, they enjoy driving it.
Which really brings up, finally, the degree to which all of these things that were part of the stimulus, the degree to which they're game-changing, the degree to which they are, will have the kind of impact that the New Deal had over the long run. The clean energy, the race to the top, digital health care, all these things, these things are not going back into the proverbial bottle.
I think for almost all of it, that's right. I mean, look, some of these things really do depend on policy. And you're seeing in states like Iowa and Colorado right now a real debate over, for instance, the tax credit for wind, where, you know, all energy is subsidized, fossil fuels perhaps the most subsidies. But the, you know, while wind has gotten much, much cheaper and is really now with its tax credit competitive on a level playing field with coal, you know, taking away that tax credit could have a real impact and you could see some reversals. That said, what I think it's true that, you know, the smart grid, which everybody had been talking about for decades but had never really gotten started, now it's started, and I think utilities are going to pick up the ball. Public policy will help determine whether it happens fast or slow, but we're not going to move back towards a dumber grid again. You know, we've got online dating and online banking. Now, as we move towards online medicine, I don't think you're going to see any groundswell to try to move back to pen and paper so that two doctors can't look at the same file if they're not in the same room. Some of these, I do think that when historians look back and whatever amount of years, they are going to look at the stimulus as the moment when America really began its transition to a low-carbon economy, a clean energy economy. Some of these things really are big. But then other things like high-speed rail, I think, you know, that really depends who's going to win in 2012. Because if Republicans control the federal government, high-speed rail used to have bipartisan support, but once it became Obama rail, that support really disappeared, and I think that could die if Obama loses.
Michael Grunewald, the book is The New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. Michael, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure.
Thank you.